Good morning and welcome. It's 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, which means it's time for books, writing and literary culture. That's what we do here on Final Draft. If you've not tuned in before, my name is Andrew Popel and Final Draft is a half hour. We talk about books, writing, we explore Australia's literary culture. And the last Saturday of the month, we have what's called the Australian Classics Book Club. Now, that is today. We go back in time, we take a classic of Australian fiction, and we really look at what makes it tick. Today on the show, we're going to be discussing Corey Taylor's Me and Mr. Booker. This is a fantastic book, well worthy of the name classic, despite not yet being even 10 years old. I'm going to be joined on the show, as usual, by David Winter. He is a senior publisher at Text Publishing, who have an amazing range of text classics. We're also joined by Benjamin Law. You probably know Ben Law from his book, The Family Law, Geisha. He wrote a fantastic quarterly essay. Ben Law is everywhere and he is such a great writer. He was also a great friend of Corey Taylor's. So he's going to be bringing his insights to our discussion. A Me and Mr. Booker is a wry and insightful story of growing up and wanting to escape where you come from. In his intro, Ben Law describes it as a riveting novel about teenagers, but not intended for teenagers. There is something here for the discerning reader, and I'm really excited to be discussing it. So that is the show today. We will be discussing the Australian classic Me and Mr. Booker after this short break.
Would $10,000 help you get your local project up and running? The City of Sydney's community, environmental, cultural and business grants are open now. Grants support projects that involve genuine community participation and assist residents, workers and visitors in the City of Sydney area. Grants close 5 p.m. Monday, July 23. Visit cityofsydney.nsw.gov.au/grants. City of Sydney sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and if you are looking at your calendar, it is the last Saturday of the month. It means it's time for the Australian Classics Book Club. We have a fantastic conversation about to hit your ears. We are discussing Corey Taylor's Me and Mr. Booker. I am joined, as always, by David Winter from Text Publishing, and I have Benjamin Law in the studio with me. He is the author of The Family Law, a fantastic quarterly essay, Moral Panic 101, Geisha, Adventures of the Queerest, and a devastatingly witty array of tweets. Welcome, Ben.
G'day, thanks for having me.
Welcome, David.
Hi, how you going?
I'm so excited to be having this conversation because I've just thoroughly enjoyed this book. I am the most recent discoverer of Me and Mr. Booker. Before we get into the book, though, David, can you give us an introduction to Corey Taylor, please?
Sure. Well, Corey was a quite remarkable person who came to book writing later in life. She was first a writer for the screen, and she did that for most of her working career. Corey was born on the Gold Coast in the mid-1950s. She actually grew up in suburban Canberra and studied film at the ANU. And by her early 30s, she had an award-winning script adapted for TV. She travelled a lot. She became particularly obsessed with Japan and married a Japanese man, and they ended up splitting their time between Japan and Brisbane, and they had two sons that they raised. Me and Mr. Booker came to Text in 2009, so Corey was, I guess, in about her mid-50s, and it really came quite out of the blue, and it was very, very short. I mean, it's still a fairly short book, but when it came, it was really a novella. But a few of us here absolutely loved it, and there was one particular editor, Caro, who worked with Corey to increase the size of the book and the quality of it as well. Corey went on to write My Beautiful Enemy. Her second novel was just as acclaimed. It was quite a beautiful story of an Australian guard who is nostalgically thinking of his love for a Japanese prisoner in an internment camp in World War II, and that was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. Corey had actually been diagnosed with cancer in the mid-2000s, and about 10 years later, in 2016, she found out that she only had a short time to live, and she wrote her third and final book, which was a really quite incredible account of dying, and it's called Dying, a Memoir. And she really faced up to death in a very, brave but also witty, intelligent, and very self-reflective kind of way. Very typical Corey approach. And that book was published around the world and was actually one of Barack Obama's favourite books of last year. But Me and Mr. Booker is where it all began in her for book writing and Corey, and I've got a very soft spot for it. I think it's a wonderful book. It's a very recent book to make a classic, but as Benjamin says in his intro, it's really it's a very fresh book, and it's unlike so much of typical Australian literature, and it sort of throws convention and caution to the wind and tries to say something very true. So that's a very Corey Taylor kind of aspect, and you know, she may have a small body of work, but I'm convinced it will endure.
I cannot wait to pick up on this idea of it being such a young classic. But first, let's get a little bit of an introduction to the book. In Me and Mr. Booker, Martha is 16. She's bored of her town, with a horror for her father's lavish interventions in her life and her mother's acceptance of this kind of way of living. Everything that happens, she tells us, is because she was waiting for it. So when the Bookers arrive on their domestic scene, Martha allows herself to be kissed, and so begins an affair that dangles the promise of an escape before her. That's a very brief introduction and really only encapsulates how we begin. There is so much more to it. And Ben, look, you've written a fabulous introduction to the text edition. It's tempting to describe the entire conversation from it, but I promise some of these ideas are my own. Can we start, though, with your relationship to Corey as a writer, and also the feeling that you express in the introduction of the need to hurl her books in people's faces, demanding they read them?
that's probably my intention, actually. The thing is, like, so Corey and I were both Brisbane people, and when I was studying at QUT, she was just finishing off her doctorate as I was beginning mine. And beyond that, we also connected because I was working at one of Brisbane's most famous bookshops, independent bookshops, Avid Reader, and she was a regular customer there. So I don't exactly know how we met, but it was either through the bookshop or through university, and I was just immediately taken with her. She's one of the most charismatic, cheeky, dry, very, very smart people you'll meet, but never intimidated me with all the people around her with how smart she was. And she just knew so much about art. She knew so much about Japan. And because she was writing a thesis that was kind of a model of what I wanted to write, she was writing a film script. And when I think about that film script now, because I was one of the people who was lucky enough to read it, that really formed the skeleton of what would later become My Beautiful Enemy. And she wrote an exegesis, like a thesis, to accompany that. And at that time, it was really, really rare for people to be writing creative works with a thesis. But because I was doing something similar, I just wanted to attach myself to her like a barnacle, like a parasite, and extract all of her knowledge. And it was only later on, you know, Corey did, she's such a good screenwriter, but she did express that kind of frustration that I think a lot of screenwriters sometimes feel, which is when you finish a script as a screenwriter, for you, that really is the work done. But of course, it needs so much more collaboration, resources, and money to get that story out into the world. And I don't know, or I don't remember when she decided, but Me and Mr. Booker just seemed to come out of the blue. I think she just even told me one day, I've written a novel, I think it's going to get published. And she seemed to work incredibly quickly. I do remember the first time I read Me and Mr. Booker, it was still in its manuscript form. She probably sent it to me as a Word doc or PDF. And I was catching a really long international flight, and I just completely demolished it very, very quickly, because Martha, who is this 16-year-old young girl who has fallen for a married man who has seduced her, her voice is so crisp, so Corey, and by the end of the first chapter, she has a married man's balls in her mouth. Like, you know, how can you not keep reading that?
I can absolutely relate. This is one
to
of
having balls in her mouth at 16 years old.
Secrets out. It is so immediate. And this is one of the few of our book clubs where I've just doubled down and I thought, look, I read this so quickly and I realized we had weeks before I was going to get to talk to both of you about this. I don't even think I knew that you were going to be our guest, Ben, although I hoped you were. And so I thought, I've got to find out more. And I had a copy of Dying, a Memoir, on my bookshelf. And so I started reading that. And between the two, I've shed far too many tears in the last couple of weeks, because that is the sort of writing that we have. And so, as you say, crisp. We're going to keep coming back with these adjectives, but they're so true.
But she writes in a way that's so stripped of any sentimentality. Mm. In fact, I think she's actually, you know, the way in which she writes or the characters whose perspective she writes from are almost contemptuous of sentimentality, and yet I think that's where the emotion comes from because it's so true. There's no syrup to her writing. Even when she writes about the most scary thing of all, death, she's not romanticizing anything. She takes things and puts a very forensic lens on things that can be so often written as cliche or stereotype. You know, a young woman having her first coming of age encounter, the process of grieving and dying. Like, these are things that have been written about so much, but it is her unique voice and her perspective that really, really sucks you in, I think.
The thing that I noticed rereading Me and Mr. Booker this time, because it's a long time since I last read it, was just how amazing it is as a debut novel, how strong it is, the strength of the voice, the assurance of the voice. And I think, you know, in a way, of course it was her first novel, but also there's obviously a huge amount that she's learned from her screenwriting, and she'd perhaps already worked on a whole other project, and then this one just sort of burst out, as you said, like quite suddenly. So it's not like a conventional first novel in that sense.
That's right. She's not feeling around for her voice. And I think the other thing is, when you come from a screenwriting background, and certainly I've kind of understood this moving from, you know, nonfiction prose to TV screenwriting, is screenwriting is incredibly demanding when it comes to the discipline of its structure. And I'm not saying that novel writing isn't, but you do have kind of parameters that are a bit more fluid. But the way that Corey writes, like, you are so compelled in the way that you would be watching a great film or a great television series. She knows how to keep that narrative tension taut. It's not a chore to read one of her books, and there's nothing kind of, you know, excessively floral about the way she writes either.
No, and it's not cinematic in the sense that it's often used to be to mean kind of lush or
like panoramic
visual.
Yeah.
It's more just that she's got, it's a pacing thing. Like, the chapters just cut forward beautifully in Me and Mr. Booker. You know, sometimes you're only taken to the next day. Other times, you know, a few weeks has elapsed, and it just, that's what propels it, I think.
I think another thing that was happening when she was writing Me and Mr. Booker from memory is that, you know, this isn't an autobiography by any means, but there are aspects of the story that Martha tells that did happen in Corey's life. And, you know, essentially this is a novel where the 16-year-old girl who is telling the story, Martha, you get the sense that she is more equipped and more mature than the adults around her who are behaving like children. And sometimes it's kind of, it reads as an indictment on ill-equipped adults or irresponsible adults. And I know that Corey did either consciously or unconsciously wait until her parents were no longer with her, and this novel just hurled out of her. I suspect, and I do remember some of the conversations I had with her, where it was like, you know, now that the parents were gone and she didn't have to worry too much about what they thought about it, this story was kind of waiting in her. That's not to dismiss, obviously, the craft that was invested into writing the novel, but it was, like you say, came out kind of this fully formed voice. It was, you know, there's a sense of inevitability about it.
So much of this book is exploring this idea of escape. Martha sort of allows herself to be taken in by the Bookers as a means to escape. Her mother's escaped a small town for a slightly bigger town and latches onto this idea of partying every weekend just to get through the idea of loneliness. Victor and Eddie are constantly moving, so Martha's father and her brother. And that's sort of counterpointed by Mrs. Booker, who just longs to be in a place. The story that you told in the introduction, though, that really sort of brought up for me this idea of the counterpoint of escape, that if you are always escaping, you've never set down roots, you've never allowed yourself to be of a place.
Yeah, but I guess also when you're growing up and the roots of your family tree are slightly toxic, as they are for Martha, the character, with her father just being a deeply unstable and unreliable figure in her life, those aren't roots that you want to take hold. And so, you know, one of the things that really resonated for me, because, you know, Corey was raised in the suburbs of Canberra before Canberra was the thriving metropolis that it is now, And I similarly was raised in the kind of suburbs of coastal Queensland, growing up and feeling like, one, you don't belong, but two, you cannot wait to get out of here. Is that that sense of wanting to escape combined with a teenage contempt for the suburbs is so well captured. I mean, there's one line that I quote in the introduction, which I think really captures her voice, where you've got characters talking to each other saying, anywhere's better than here, you need to get away. If you stay here, you'll wind up with some boring nobody called Shane or Wally who wants six kids and a brick veneer in the burbs. And one day you'll wake up and decide to stick your head in the oven because it's better than facing another conversation about football or whether little Wally is a faggot because he likes reading books. You know, like that, there's that bite and humour combined with the misery that makes the misery tolerable. That really spoke to me when I first read this book.
That's far too real and true a caricature of Australian masculinity. Victor as well. He almost reaches caricature point in the things that he does, and yet again, I can relate probably almost everything he does to a male that has passed through my orbit in my life. It's so real.
But it's a great kind of antidote to, I guess, a lot of what we'd consider Australian classics that actually valorises a certain type of Australian masculinity. You know, we've got the larrikin, we've got the drover, we've got the bushman, we've got all those kind of, you know, publican manly men. And here we've actually got a really recognisable other archetype of an Australian man that we don't really represent as much in our classic literature, but is instantly recognisable and makes us uncomfortable because of how recognisable he is. The absent father, the feckless family man, the one who just doesn't have his shit together. And that's a really, really kind of great counterpoint to other Australian men we've seen in classic books.
Yeah, he's kind of a petty tyrant as well. Yeah. So, Andrew, there's a little bit of an echo of some of the Amy Whiting males and some of the other figures that we've talked about, through even back to sort of Elizabeth Harrower. So there is a sort of strand of writing there. Like Corey almost joins that lineage, and those books are classics because they're good. But the reason that they're in the classic series is because they've tended to be disregarded and kind of secondary in Australian literature.
Well, we've taken those few tentative steps, so let's just absolutely run with this idea of a classic classic of Australian literature, and where me and Mr. Booker fits in this, because this is a young book. I commented to Ben before we started the conversation, my bookmark is older than this book. I've got a bookmark which is bizarrely a 2006 calendar. I don't know where it came from, but this is a very young book. It deals with places that are going to be very familiar to a lot of people still alive, and yet it is also recognizable as instantly classic. What makes it so? How does it become a classic in our mind? Can we even pinpoint it?
And I wonder what those conversations were like at Text Publishing, considering this book did only come out, I think, in 2011.
Yeah, look, it was I won't lie and say it was an emotionless decision. You know, there are a lot of people who were very attached to Corey and Corey's writing and want to see it recognised. But, you know, anything that goes into the series has to make the grade. And it was easy enough to look at it again and sort of say, well, you know, the book is very, as I said earlier, very assured. It's a book that really resonates quality. It won't be to everyone's cup of tea because it's not an easy book to read. I found it probably harder going this time around than the first time.
Oh, what was different?
I found it less funny this time. I found it sadder, actually, because I think that everyone is... there's a sort of callousness, maybe not cruelty, but callousness about so many of the people in the book. I think that's very true. I mean, I think the characters are rich to me. I think they're real. I found it really dark on this read, and I felt really conflicted about who was exploiting whom. And
yes.
I mean, I guess the simple answer is that to some degree, everyone is at fault in this book. There's this amazing... bit late. It was a very, very brief comment where Martha says, "Oh, I guess Mum did know the best for me." You know, when she's packing, she packs Martha off to Sydney and is really pushing her. She's like, "Oh, she knew I need to get away from Mr. Booker." It's like, but the rest of the book, you know, she's just turned a blind eye to what's going on. This 34-year-old man is sleeping with a who's married,
yes,
and is about to have a child. Is sleeping with her 16-year-old daughter.
Man-child predator.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, Martha's not a complete innocent either, because as you said, Ben, she, you know, right from the first page, she's very sussed. You know,
yeah.
And she's sort of figured out the phoniness of adults. But I realise in saying all of that that I've utterly failed to answer the question of why this is a... I mean, you can say I'm passionate about the book. I think that this is a very, very fresh take on fairly familiar kind of territory. It is an Australian classic, but to me it's actually a very English-influenced book. On this read, I was thinking of plays like Look Back in Anger, and Mr. Booker is almost... he's sort of out of one of those angry young men plays of the 1960s where, you know, he's grown up in probably some poverty, lower middle class or working class. He's scraped his way to uni. He's teaching film studies, although he seems better at drinking. And, you know, but all the rage has kind of dissipated, and now he's just trapped and kind of pathetic. And so I started to think a lot about how this book has quite a bit to say about the relationship between England and Australia and about class, because, you know, we don't just have Australian males in this story. We've got this English figure who is the predatory lecturer. I still haven't answered the question.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think this novel pulls off that's really difficult to do, and I know this because, you know, we've kind of been trying to do it in the TV show that I write for SBS, but, you know, to write something about a younger character that where the readership isn't for that younger audience is a really difficult thing to pull off, I think, for an adult to always be completely invested in a teenage story, because this teenager is very much in an adult world. And for that tone to even work is this really precarious balancing act for an author. But for her to write a book about a teen experience that isn't YA fiction, that is so completely set within the adult world, she does it so well, and she pulls every adult reader right back to when they were that precocious teen. That's why I think,
yeah,
it's such a singularly great voice.
Yeah, and I think that this a book like this would be looked at through these days in the publishing terms, would be looked at through the lens of young adult fiction, and then of course people, you know, rear back in horror because of the moral complexity, and the sheer kind of don't give a shit kind of quality of the writing. But I think it's really important that it isn't a young adult book, that it's very much a book for adults, and it really makes you, well, me anyway, think about the behaviour of adults, not of teenagers, because this is not about... it's told from Martha's perspective, but really it is her. She doesn't do a huge amount of self-examination in the novel.
No.
It's really just her forensic look at all these other people around who are basically messing up their lives.
It's that book you'll read as quickly as young adult fiction,
yes,
because it's so, so moorish, and yet, like you say, David, it's not YA because of that moral complexity. It can't be didactic. A young woman does come of age, but the lessons she learns are actually quite hideous ones, you know? Then there's no kind of clean... No one comes out of this clean.
Yeah, I found it so hard to try and be emotionless and just enjoy this as a book as I read. And that connects with what I think we're talking about here and what made it so classic for me. Because I guess I read it at the same time as I seem to have read quite a lot of books that deal with the issues around violence against women. And these books dealt with actual physical violence as well as emotional violence. And very much, I think what happens in Me and Mr. Booker can be viewed in those terms. Martha is very savvy. She's very forthright. But there is also a violence being done to her.
This guy is twice her age, almost.
And because of this assured voice, I kept struggling with this idea of, do I just roll with this? Because Martha... I'm talking about her like she's a person,
deserves
agency,
yeah.
But also I can't help but see what's happening, and I couldn't let that go, and it connected with what I was reading. Also, I think what the world is discussing at the moment, that's what makes it a classic for me. In 10 years' time, just as it was 10 years ago, or almost 10 years ago, and now, it will deal with issues that we need to explore, and it gives us a voice that we can take that trip with.
Yeah, Corey is such a sort of cut-through writer, all three of her books, and she was like, I only met her face-to-face once, corresponded with her a bit, but she was just like that as a person. She was incredibly warm, but straight to the point, and as you said right up the front, Ben, just incredibly sharp. You know, she'd seen it all and knew it all, but just was so witty and friendly in the way that she would impart her knowledge.
Yeah, so funny, and an absolute zero tolerance for bullshit.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, one of the things I think she really delighted in was calling on bullshit, whether it was in politics or arts or in writing, you know, and that would be, I think, her idea of a great time, just having a ball-tearing discussion about why something was phony or fake.
I wonder if I can connect to that, and this might be maybe how we sort of trail out our book club today, something that I picked up from reading Dying, a memoir, and it really fascinated me, because I, having read that, I also realised that Me and Mr. Booker contains elements from Corey's life. She writes about her experience of writing, that writing, even if most of the time you're only doing it in your head, shapes the world and makes it bearable.
It's a great quote, isn't it?
I love it, yeah, and it got me thinking. I was talking about this book this morning, and it got me thinking about my job. I'm a speech pathologist. I work with language, and I help people develop their ability to talk about themselves and how we narrativize every day. Every person is a writer, at least of their own life. And Corey, again, she talks about that in Dying. She says you might as well write your own life before someone else does it for you.
Yes.
And it's such a wonderful thing. And I think, again, it makes Me and Mr. Booker a classic for me, because in taking this journey, it's not our journey. I mean, no person in this conversation can pretend that anything like Me and Mr. Booker has happened to them, especially because we're all men. But it still gives us perspective to start to write, to write our own lives, to make sense of our own lives. Have I been clear? I feel like I've been very unclear there.
No, I totally agree. And I think that Me and Mr. Booker is a really good case too, where it's done with real style and flair.
Well, I think we have done such a wonderful job covering this book. I'm going to reintroduce the book, because you are in the Australian Classics Book Club, where we are discussing Corey Taylor's Me and Mr. Booker. I'm joined by David Winter, Senior Editor at Text Publishing, and Benjamin Law. Ben, you were a friend, an acquaintance, a mentor. You knew Corey.
Mentee, of course. Yeah,
well, she describes you a mentor.
I mean, it's kind of strange, because obviously I always saw her as someone who had all this knowledge to impart on me. But I love the fact that she saw that relationship as reciprocal.
I'd love to give you the last word to our audience on getting out and reading Me and Mr. Booker.
The funny thing is, with all of her books, on paper, they should be tough prospects to read. You know, Me and Mr. Booker is essentially about a 16-year-old girl who is taken advantage of by a married man. My Beautiful Enemy is about, you know, Japanese internment in Australian history. And Dying, a Memoir, is a memoir about dying. And all I need to do is to tell people to read the first few pages of any of her books, and they're completely captivated and seduced by this voice, you know, a voice that David and I have heard in real life, which is, as soon as she speaks, you want to have a chat with her for the longest time possible. And that's the experience of reading her books. Like David said, it was Dying, a Memoir, was one of Barack Obama's picks of last year when the book came out in America. There is a reason why Julian Barnes and Hilary Mantel all count themselves as fans of this Australian writer that more people need to know about, because as soon as you start reading her, you will want to be evangelical about her too.
Wow. Thank you, David Winter. Thank you, Benjamin Law.
Thank you
so
much.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
That's it for today's final draft. I have taken it absolutely down to the wire because it has been such a fantastic conversation. The Vulture's Nest is coming up next, so don't go anywhere. My name is Andrew Popel. Final Draft will be back next week with more books, writing, and literary culture. So I'll see you then.